I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When Donald Trump announced his bid for the presidency, not many people thought he would win. But Roger Stone, one of the president's longtime friends and advisors, had been urging him to run for years. Today we get Stone's insights into the Trump victory and ask how he saw what most of the media clearly missed. Then Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach is known throughout the country for his unwavering pursuit of illegal voting. We'll hear about one Kansan who Kobach caught voting twice and how the system created to discover the duplicate voting is coming under fire. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If anybody understands President Donald Trump, it's Roger Stone, who's worked alongside Trump off and on since 1979. During last year's presidential campaign, Stone was an informal advisor to Trump. In August 2015, Trump's campaign announced that it had fired Stone, but Stone insisted that wasn't the case. In any event, Roger Stone has written a new book on the epic campaign that just was the making of the president 2016. Stone had ties to Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon and was once a senior campaign aide to our own Bob Dole. Roger Stone joins us now by Skype. And Roger, nice to have you. Good morning.
Delighted to be here.
Let's talk about where this new president is right now, Roger, because most polls, as you know, have the new president upside down on job approval, meaning more Americans disapprove of the job he's doing than approve. Why such a bad start? Because you know as well as anyone that new presidents traditionally are in much better shape coming out of the gate.
Well, perhaps, but let's be clear. Many of these polls are the same pollsters and organizations who assured us that Hillary Clinton would win in a walk.
Fair point.
And there are a number of outliers out there, pollsters who did get the election right, who are showing Trump, the president, with a higher, approval around 50.
Right.
We have an extremely polarized atmosphere. The president got no honeymoon. He was under attack the minute he was sworn in before. They ran this, and I'm intricately and personally involved, they ran this whole Russian narrative into the ground. And I have written and said repeatedly, I know of and was not involved in any effort by the Russians to assist Donald Trump in his campaign or to undermine Hillary. It's a canard. There's just nothing there.
Well, given all this,
that whole thing has obviously hurt the president. Notwithstanding, however, his swift action on a series of executive actions has very much continued to galvanize his base, which is the key to politics. Despite the fact that a few of his appointments may not be their cup of tea. Elliot Abrams at stake, that may be a bridge too far, but right now the president has enormous goodwill among his supporters, even the most conservative ones, the purists, because A, they're so euphoric about his victory, and B, he is still an outsider and adverse to the, two-party ruling elite within the Beltway, the establishment.
What would you advise him, Roger, if you were sitting in the Oval Office with him right now? What does he need to do now, in your view? Tone it down, amp it up? What would you tell him?
Well, I mean, the problem here, of course, is it's a perfectly fair question, but you're kind of looking through the prism of how one would work with a career politician or someone other than Donald Trump. This is a man who is not coached or scripted or practiced, or speaking off of talking points written by someone else, or who you put words in his mouth. It is literally impossible. He is his own man. He does listen to a much broader cross-section of advice than you might think. But at the end of the day, it wouldn't matter what I or someone else said. He's going to choose what to do. I think he's doing the most important thing, which is to remain focused on his driving his agenda. He's got to do as much as he can do by executive order. does kind of tickle me that the Democrats are complaining about that because, you know, live by the sword, die
by the sword. Yeah. Yeah.
But at the same time, he is, you know, these sideshow contretemps with the media, you know, I don't think they matter to the voters. They certainly don't matter to Trump's supporters. One of the things we saw in the campaign was how intense and resilient his support base was. So mm-hmm. even when there were what some might call gaffes, let's say the attack on Senator McCain, sure, Trump went down 2 points. And the next day he was up 4. I mean, nothing seemed to have any lasting effect. The same thing was true where he criticized a judge who was of Mexican-American heritage. And he, you know, everybody said that was it. The bottom would drop out. I think he still has that resilience because of the intensity of, you know, his supporters.
And Roger, why is that? Why does he have this resilience that no one else last year seemed to have, and no other presidential candidate that I can recall ever seemed to have? What was Donald Trump's secret?
Well, I don't think it's so much, it's not about the president as much as it's about the country. In the 10 presidential campaigns I have done, and by the way, one of the greatest patriots I ever had the honor of working for was Senator Bob Dole. Hmm. And when he showed up at the convention to endorse the ticket and to endorse Trump, he demonstrated again that he's a man who puts his country first, unlike the Bushes who put themselves first. Hmm. End of commercial. but I love Bob Dole. He was one of the greatest men I have ever had the privilege to work for. In any event, but in the past, in these presidential campaigns, I'd never seen the voters so sour, so angry, so disillusioned. There's a tenor of the anger which really the president picked up before anyone else. They are no longer trust career politicians. They no longer trust political institutions. But here's what's different than previous elections. They also no longer trust the media. They have figured out that many, not all, many in the mainstream media are in the tank, have become ideological, or I should say partisan, and that they cannot be trusted as a source of news. Combine that with the technological advance that more people are now receiving their news on their handheld device, right, rather than through a television set, the tipping point's been reached. And that opens the door to a whole cross-section of different, more diverse, you know, sources of information. 2016 was the year that the mainstream media monopoly on political information ended.
Will it ever come back?
Was finally crushed.
Is it ever going to come back?
No, because it's technological. The problem here is that television and cable are outmoded technologically, and that's why – and nobody – is going to say, oh, I've got to rush home to see my favorite program at 7 anymore. Mm-hmm. All of our news and our entertainment is on demand now. So it's the technological advance, I think, is going to put more and more people getting their entertainment from the net, even less reason for the networks to exist. And the infrastructure to run a cable system is hundreds and hundreds of, I guess, billions of dollars, at least, if not hundreds of millions, when you can do it on the net for far, far less and reach as many people. So their economic model no longer holds up. Cable will go the way of the buggy whip eventually.
Long time Donald Trump advisor Roger Stone is my guest. His new book, The Making of the President 2016. You have said, Roger, that Donald Trump as president is more like Richard Nixon than Ronald Reagan. How so?
Well, I had the privilege to spend substantial time with both men. I think Reagan is one of the greatest presidents of my lifetime. And I worked for him in 3 presidential campaigns. I got to know Richard Nixon in his post-presidential years, mm-hmm. because when I worked for him earlier in my career, I was only 19 years old. So I got to shake his hand once when he swept through the headquarters. I was pretty junior. Hmm. But I spent substantial time with the former president afterwards. Trump is more like Nixon in the sense that he is pragmatic. He's not really an ideologue. He has conservative tendencies. He has progressive tendencies on certain other issues. Gay marriage would be a perfect example. He is interested in what works. He's interested in solutions rather than purity. The president does have some of the qualities of Reagan. He's tall, he's broad shoulders. He has that Reagan-esque commanding presence. It's very hard to put your finger on this. It's more than charisma. It is more than magnetism. As Kissinger recently said, Trump fills the room like former presidents I've worked for. So I do think that he has the best of both men. Also, like Nixon, Trump is determined, focused, incredibly stubborn when he sets his mind about doing something. And that's why we're going to get a wall.
Tell us a little bit more about him and his personal side, Roger, because you know it and a lot of us don't. Critics say he has this unbridled ego. He's an egomaniac who has no business issuing orders inside the Oval Office. His toughest critics say he's unstable. What do you say to people who bring that stuff up to you?
They said the exact same thing about Theodore Roosevelt. Specifically, those things. He was an egomaniac and he was mentally unstable. And of course, they said Andrew Jackson was crude, vulgar, uninformed. Two of our greatest presidents. I don't think these things can be seen. And the problem is the people making those judgments are partisans. Wouldn't matter how Trump was doing, they would still say that he was not up to the job. So I think it can only be seen in the totality of it. We won't know. But he has a unique opportunity to be a transformational president, not a transitional president, but to fundamentally change, 30 years of decline, 30 years of endless war and massive debt and spending, erosion of our civil liberties, a foreign policy that is incoherent, trade deals that suck the jobs out of the country, and lastly, of course, an immigration policy that leaves our streets unsafe.
But the immigration order, came about 10 days ago, obviously white hot, controversial. Was that brought before the American people in an effective way, Roger? What's your sense? How would you have handled that differently?
I've heard arguments that it could have been rolled out differently, but I think it's naive. The UN cry that we hear would have been heard no matter what. Let's be candid. The order affected 109 people who were frozen in transit. 109.
But the optics suggested it was something a lot broader. A larger statement was being made here.
And the month before, I think we let 350,000 people into the country. So it needs to be seen in some perspective. By the way, even some of the president's harshest poll numbers show more than 50% supporting the ban. That rather surprised me this morning.
I've seen it both ways.
Politico. Fair enough, but then we're back to the same question who they're sampling and so on.
I want to ask you a quick question about yourself, Roger, because Trump calls you a tough cookie. That's on the cover of your new book, The Making of the President 2016. You call yourself the Prince of Darkness. You've accused Ted Cruz during the campaign last year of having affairs with multiple women. Jack Anderson, the famous columnist, once called you out as a dirty trickster for Richard Nixon. And back in first grade in 1960, you tried to boost John F. Kennedy's campaign for president by telling kids in the cafeteria line that Richard Nixon was in favor of school on Saturdays. So my question is, how far will you go to win, Roger?
I'm prepared to do anything to help my candidates short of breaking the law. Look, politics ain't beanbag.
But how about accuracy and fairness?
Do you think our CIA is not out putting out disinformation every day?
But that's a different argument. I'm talking about political campaigns in this country.
I'm not suggesting my candidate say something dishonest. But as far as Ted Cruz is concerned, if you read my book, you'll see that I document all the things I said about him. There's almost two chapters there on him. So you might want to look at it.
But why accuse Ted Cruz of having? Why accuse Ted Cruz of having affairs when Donald Trump has been accused of the same thing?
Quote, if I may, this is true, it would be problematic with his Christian base. Many people believe where there is smoke, there is fire. My sources in Texas, really excellent within the party, have provided me with names and enough information that I believe it's true. But I also go in and
but there's no proof, though, Roger.
Father's involvement in New Orleans in 1963.
But there's no proof of the affairs, though, right?
Why do we think the end of this story's been written?
Well, because you made the accusations during the 2016 campaign.
No, I did not make an accusation. Please reread the piece. I chose my words very carefully. National Enquirer made an accusation.
Oh, that's fair, but you certainly insinuated. Things were insinuated.
Insinuation, yeah, okay. Oh, I agree, probably were. This is politics. And by the way, I think the charge is true. If the senator wants to pursue this further, which I assure you he does not, there are many, many in the Texas Republican Party and in Washington who know what Ted Cruz really is. Don't think he's the crusader, the moral crusader, nor the constitutionalist, nor the conservative that he purports to be. And I make that case in my book.
And your point is that side of him needs to be known in a rough and tumble campaign for the presidency of the United States.
I did not provide the information to the National Enquirer. It was given to them by a different presidential campaign.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've had Jeff Rowe on this program, our one-time Kansas City-based Republican political operative who's gone national. He uses the exact same quote you do, Roger: politics ain't beanbag.
No, Rowe is a very tough and talented guy, and he did an excellent job for his candidate, in my view. They ran a very, very good campaign, coming from far behind with, long shot resources, and they were the finisher. They didn't win the nomination, but it came down to two. That is to be applauded and recognized as talent.
If insinuations that Ted Cruz had these affairs isn't off limits, my question is there any political tactic that is off limits to you?
Well, but again, insinuations. First, I would prefer to call this first reports.
Okay.
Who knows what the senator will pursue to do in the future? Maybe after 8 years of the presidency, he may be too old to run for president, or maybe he gets appointed to the Supreme Court and this matter comes up in his confirmation. Anything is possible.
Let's go back to Trump. I mean, is he too combative for his own good? Is he capable of toning it down when he's advised to tone it down? Because I assume over the course of many years, you've coached him a number of times and maybe he listened and then disregarded.
Now, you don't coach Donald Trump. That's not how you work for him. That's not how you serve him. And that's not his style. He is very, he's pugnacious. There's no question. If you punch Trump, you're going to get punched back. He is not going to put up with what he believes to be misrepresented or smeared. And he is going to continue to criticize some, and this is the key word, some in the media. It would be a huge mistake to say that everyone in the mainstream media is dishonest and biased and just carrying the narrative of the Democrats. That's not true. There are many good, honest, hardworking reporters who are just trying to get it right. But there are others that violate both journalistic ethics and go much further in their, in their reports. On top of all of this, I don't think the president is being well served by White House aides who are leaking like a sieve. How else would we hear the allegation that the president wears a bathrobe when he's in the family quarters, as if anybody cares?
Right.
Place is drafty. I'd wear a bathrobe too.
Why is this White House leaking like a sieve, in your words?
Well, I think it's because some of the people who have been hired to work for the president were not Trump supporters, were, more party oriented. They don't necessarily share the president's views. They're more mechanics. And that's the great danger when you throw the doors open. I would point out that when Jim Baker, who was George Bush's campaign manager, a very, very able man, and a friend, became Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, the first thing he did was reach out to a number of very high-profile Reaganites and bring them into high-profile positions in the White House staff. Lynn Nofziger, and so on. Mm-hmm. And of course, Ed Meese, the president's counselor, was kind of the Steve Bannon of his day, if you will, mm-hmm. focused on issues and so on, with working closely with the president. You know, Reince Priebus has not done that. I would have advised him to go get some of the very best of the Trump people, David Urban from Pennsylvania, Ed Martin from Missouri, sure. Candace Jackson from California. These are able, capable people. But instead we are hiring establishment Republicans, which is why we read in the Washington Post that the president is like a clueless child.
So he needs a clean house, you're suggesting, Roger.
Well, it's just stunning disloyalty. It's not help. I mean, I know a little bit about leaking. There are strategic leaks. The president may want something leaked for a strategic purpose. That's the grand game of politics. Franklin Roosevelt was a master at it. But when you leak to make yourself look good, or when you leak to try to kill an internal rival, your leak is disparaging of your boss. You're hurting the president. You're hurting, you know, I think that violates the professionalism, what you're supposed to do. It's embarrassing. It really is outrageous.
What do you make of the president's selection of Steve Bannon as a top advisor? Good choice, not a good choice? Where do you come down there?
Well, I have defended Bannon. I write for Breitbart, full disclosure. Bannon is a friend. He's a thinker. He's an issues guy. He's a big picture guy. He is not a manager, I think, by his own admission. He is totally copacetic with the president's worldview. The idea that this is Bannon's worldview and that Donald Trump is adhering to it is backwards. These guys figured out that they had a kinship before Bannon joined the campaign. They saw the major issues, particularly immigration, the same way. I think that's how they bonded. But the whole Bannon is Trump's brain, Bannon is the de facto president, that is coming from others on the White House staff who think that narrative will undermine Bannon with the president.
And that's not an accurate depiction, you're saying.
It's most definitely not. Having worked for Trump on and off for almost 40 years, nobody is his brain but him. He is his own strategist and his own speechwriter and his own conceptualizer. I mean, he is his own man. So Bannon is not pulling his strings. He is pulling Bannon's strings to the extent that Steve's job is to implement the big picture vision on trade, on immigration, on the economic plan, and so on. And traditionally, the White House chief of staff, you know, makes the trains run on time. It's not a substance job. It's a mechanical job. This chief of staff, Reince Priebus, the former RNC chairman, never seems to leave the president's side. I can't really understand how he can perform the functions of chief and staff and also be essentially the body man. Bob Haldeman writes in his book about how this was a problem because that Nixon would erode huge hours of his time mm-hmm. when he just wanted Haldeman to sit there and muse with him when Haldeman had to go make the trains run on time.
Roger Stone's my guest. His new book, The Making of the President 2016. He's a longtime advisor to Donald Trump. We're hoping to get some insight into the new president. What about the president's penchant for using Twitter a lot, Roger, and the country is reacting to that in a whole bunch of different ways. What do you make of it? Is this an effective way for him to communicate?
It's an extraordinarily powerful weapon because it allows him to get into the information into the hands of 16 million people without it being filtered. And therefore, he can circumvent all the media, mainstream and alternative. He can talk directly to people. Like he likes to say, it's like owning a newspaper without the debt. There's no chance that he is going to stop doing it. He loves it. It's been a very effective communications tool for him throughout the campaign, and it can continue to do so. Look, I have sent tweets that I later regret. It happens. Call them two martini tweets. You apologize for them if they're due an apology. the president obviously is going to decide what he tweets, but I wouldn't, you know, he's not going to be restrained. It's mm-hmm. just not his style. Just not his style.
You know, there's an interesting nugget in this book about Vice President Mike Pence, and the story goes that Pence was going to endorse Ted Cruz until the Trump team told him that he would be a top candidate for vice president for Trump if he didn't endorse. Tell us about that story, because ultimately, in sort of a quiet way, Pence did endorse Ted Cruz but said nice things about Trump at the same time. But give us some insight into that interplay involving the vice president.
Yeah, I only have, unfortunately, one side of the narrative, but enough confirmations to believe that I've got it accurate, meaning I can't tell you what was going on in the vice president's head at that time. He did, in fact, in the end, give a quiet, endorsement to Ted Cruz. But, Paul Manafort was running the campaign at that time. The alternatives that they were looking at were Chris Christie, whose subsequent George Washington Bridge problems would have destroyed this ticket.
Yeah.
Particularly given the timing, and Newt Gingrich, who, while I like Newt, that's a lot of hair. I mean, that's very 80s. And, you know, we have the ongoing problem that the Andy Warhol Museum may want their wig back. So,
Roger, you know, come
Newt's,
on.
Newt's a friend. Newt's a friend. I love him. And he laughs at that joke harder than anyone else.
Yeah.
So it is, but, you know, Pence, in my view, and I think the view of the Trump family and Trump's circle of advisors, that Pence was a stronger candidate than either of them. And he turned out to be exactly the right candidate. So I think he demolished his opponent in the debate, but he never came on too strong. I think he reassured evangelical Christians and conservatives that Trump could be trusted, even though he's not a purist, he's not an ideologue, and that he has had a change of heart on some issues. He definitely changed positions on abortion after the birth of his youngest son. So I think, you know, it was a wise choice on the folks around the president. Kellyanne Conway, of course, had been Pence's pollster in mm-hmm. his House and governor's races. So she had and has a strong relationship with him. I think he was the ideal running mate.
I want to ask you maybe a final point here. You've said in the past that divine intervention, no less than divine intervention, has been at play in Donald Trump's life. And you've mentioned a helicopter crash back in 1989. Tell us that story.
Yeah. BuzzFeed, Wayne Barrett of The Village Voice, Harry Hurd, who wrote a biography of Trump, all wrote that in the 1980s, when there was an incident in which three of Donald Trump's top executives were flying down to Atlantic City. Donald was, in fact, originally supposed to be with them. It was a leased helicopter. The helicopter crashed in the Pinelands, and everybody aboard was killed. All three of those journalists say that is completely fabricated, and that Donald was never supposed to be on that plane, and that he peddled it to the reporters and gossip columnists to get publicity. That is not true, as I reveal in the book. I was working for him then, doing some lobbying work in Washington. We had a time-sensitive matter, and I asked to fly up immediately and see him. He told me he could not see me because he was going to Atlantic City with a group of executives. I told him the matter wouldn't wait. He said, fine, come up. I'll wait for you, and then I'll just go down later in the day. While we were sitting there meeting, his longtime assistant, Norma Federer, who is a very capable lady, came in ashen-faced and says, Mr. Trump, I have terrible news. The helicopter's crashed, and the superintendent of state police is on the phone for you. And Donald put him on the speaker. His name was Clint Pagano. And he said, Mr. Trump, I have terrible news. This helicopter has gone down, and there were no survivors. Donald simply said, are you absolutely certain? And the veteran cop said, yes, sir, 100%. I do not say I saved Donald Trump's life. It's kind of the moment at which I realized there was something larger at play here. I really think his life was spared for a different purpose, for a bigger purpose. And in this case, I'm sure he met with others after he met with me, but to the extent that I had involvement, I was doing God's will. At the same time, it disproves this charge that he made this up, which he most definitely did not.
All right. Roger Stone's new book, The Making of the President 2016. Roger, I appreciate the time. Thanks very much.
Steve, thank you very much for having me. This was great.
You bet. All the best. Time for a break. When we come back, double voting in Kansas. We'll talk about it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, how vocational and technical education and smart urban planning can set local economies up for success. We also heard about manufacturing and operating food trucks. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, our panel of media critics review coverage of Trump's presidency and look at how journalism will or won't change because of it. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, most of us know that Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach has made pursuit of voter fraud a cornerstone of his time in office. Well, Kobach might want to spend some time with a man named Randall Killian of Hayes, Kansas. Killian was indicted for double voting, or voting in two states in the same election. That's a no-no, and Killian was convicted of a misdemeanor count of voting without being qualified. It cost him $2,500. With us now to talk about the case of Randall Killian and its implications, as well as Chris Kobach's pursuit of voter fraud, is KCUR's Peggy Lowe, whose story on Killian came out this morning. Peggy, nice to have you, as always.
Good morning, Steve.
Mark Johnson is also here. He's a partner at Denton's and teaches at both the KU School of Law and the Journalism School. He's gone toe-to-toe with Chris Kobach in several cases and currently represents the latest person accused of double voting by the Kansas Secretary of State. Mark, it's nice to have you, too.
Steve, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Mark Johnson, did Chris Kobach have to criminally prosecute Randall Killian, or could he have done something less drastic? What's your sense?
He certainly could have done something much less drastic. Filing this complaint against him. If every prosecutor prosecuted every possible case, the courts would have nothing else to do. What happens in the vast majority of cases, and I think what should have happened in all of these so-called dual voting cases, is what's called prosecutorial discretion. Chris should simply have decided to send this fellow a letter saying, don't do it again. Then that would take care of it. Mm-hmm. But he chose to file this complaint against him. He forced this guy to hire a lawyer, pay several thousand dollars to a lawyer, forced him to plead guilty to a crime. It's going to be on his record permanently. It's not necessary.
Oh, why do you think he did it this way?
Candidly, I think he did it because, as I've been quoted as saying, he's grandstanding. He's trying to help himself, I think, politically. It keeps his name in the news. If what he's really trying to do is bring an end to what he considers to be voter fraud, the best thing to do is simply to tell those people to stop doing it, and it will come to an end. Hmm. And in the time that he's had the right to file these cases, in the last year and a half or so, he's filed, I believe, 9 of them,
mm-hmm.
all dual voting cases, no voter impersonation cases, nothing like that. And he exacts guilty pleas from these people. And it's not necessary. It's simply not necessary.
Peggy Lowe, who is Randall Killian? Let's go to your story here. And what did he do?
Randall Killian is a 63-year-old geologist out in western Kansas. He lives in Hayes. His family homesteaded here. I mean, this guy's been here forever. He has a spotless record, not even a parking ticket. And I checked with the DA because Randall initially told me that. I called him and said I wanted to talk to him. And it was very upsetting for him. He's like, why don't these reporters stop bugging me? What do you need to know? This is old news. And I said, we just need to hear from someone that this happened to. We need to have your side of the story. Chris Kobach is out there saying that there's all these people illegally voting. What happened with you? And so he told me. So
what did happen with him?
So he's 63 years old, and he has bought some retirement property out in Colorado. He gets a mail-in ballot. Like, so he had kind of set up some shop out in Colorado, right? He's going to live down by Castle Rock. And he got a driver's license, among other things, and you can register to vote. So he gets a mail-in ballot in 2012. That year was the year Colorado voted on marijuana. And he thought, wow, this is cool.
Big issue.
It's a huge issue. And they changed the Constitution, for heaven's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
And he had told another reporter, not me, that he was concerned about his property values in Colorado. So he thought, okay, I'm going to vote on this. Then he later voted in Kansas, too. He gets a call from the local DA and says, hey, this has been flagged, like years later.
I was going to say, years later this happened. Yeah.
Years later, because his first call was from a reporter saying, you know, he's been indicted. And Tom Dees, he is the Ellis County prosecutor. I talked to him. And Mr. Dees said, hey, you did this. What happened? And he said, oh, I didn't even know it. It was an honest mistake. I forgot, you know, and he's like, really, you can't vote in two states? A lot of people don't know that you can't. And I know that seems sort of ridiculous, but his feeling was, I own property in two states. I want to have a say in the school board, among other things. This is my tax dollars.
It seems like it makes sense.
Makes sense. So Tom Dees, you know, got the story from him. And Tom said he decided not to prosecute because he said he felt like it had a high potential of jury nullification. And what that means is
a jury would listen to the case and walk away.
Absolutely. They'd go, look at this nice guy. He's a hardworking geologist with a spotless record, and he made a mistake.
Mark, was that prosecutor's thinking appropriate? In your
Absolutely.
View?
That's what a prosecutor should do in a case like this. Why make an example of somebody if you can accomplish what you want by getting them to voluntarily comply with the law? And in this case, having brought it to Mr. Killian's attention, he was never going to do it again. And if the secretary's intent is to bring dual voting to an end, that's how you go about doing it.
Well, did Chris Kobach ever speak to Mark Killian, as far as we know?
As far as we know, absolutely not. And I can tell you that nobody from Kansas ever called the guy that I'm representing, Preston Christensen. And they claim that he double voted in 2012. It's questionable whether he did or didn't. But the fact is, no one from Kansas ever called him. No one from Kansas ever conducted any kind of investigation before they indicted him.
What does Kobach's office say about that, Peggy? Why didn't he contact Mr. Killian or Mark's client as well?
Well, Kobach wouldn't talk to us. And his spokeswoman, who did help me with some details, just never responded to my many requests for Mr. Kobach to talk to us. So I don't quite know. I want to say, too, we just learned before going on the air that Mark Johnson here does represent Preston Christensen, the ninth person charged in these cases. And what's interesting about Mr. Christensen is he's Republican, like most of the people Kobach has charged. He's 28, so he's a lot younger than the older white Republicans that Kobach has charged for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's your client's story here, Mark? Why did he allegedly double vote, or did he, or what do you know about it?
Well, I've talked to him about it. He grew up in Topeka, went to Washburn Rural High School, and graduated in 2007, and then went to SMU. He graduated from there in 2011. He's got multiple degrees. He works in the financial industry down there. And he thinks what might have happened in 2012 is that he filled out an absentee ballot for Kansas. He personally never sent it in. Somebody might have sent it in for him. He just doesn't. He honestly doesn't know.
Right.
But he did vote in Texas because he decided at that point that he'd lived in Texas. He was going to stay in Texas. That's where he should vote.
Mm-hmm. So in theory, did he know he shouldn't vote in two states?
Oh, sure. I mean, everybody certainly knows that.
I have to say
that.
I didn't.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is Texas investigated. Texas sent somebody out to talk to him three and a half years ago. That's the only time anybody ever talked to him about this.
And what did Texas do about this?
Nothing.
They walked away from it, too.
Absolutely. But what the investigators told him was, well, it sounds like this was unintentional. And if he sent that ballot in, it was unintentional. And as I read the law in Kansas, the double voting has to be intentional, has to be knowing. That's one real problem I have with these prosecutions is that I think in 99 cases out of 100, it's a mistake. It's an accident. They didn't understand what the law was. And honestly, Steve, as you well know, these election laws are confusing.
Yeah.
And they're changing all the time. People don't know what their situation is. And it's really unfortunate for this guy to be accused of a crime.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about double voting in Kansas and a crusade from Secretary of State Chris Kobach to crack down on it. Peggy, one question that becomes very obvious that your story very much deals with here is, how would Secretary of State Kobach know that anyone voted more than once? How is the system set up to deal with that?
So my story focused on what's called the Interstate Cross-Check System.
Cross-check.
This is a huge database started in 2005 by then Secretary of State Ron, is it Thornburg?
Thornburg. Here in Kansas it started.
Here in Kansas. Sometimes it's called the Kansas Project. So initially it was just four states. It was Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri. And it was just an effort by the Secretary of State to keep voter rolls clean. You know, when dead people, fall out, or when dead people don't vote anymore, you take their name off the roll. Or when people move from, say, Kansas to Missouri, which happens all the time here. So, but under Kobach, who inherited this in 2011, the cross-check system has grown to 100 million voter registrations
because
in
he's
30
gone,
states.
I was going to say he's gone beyond the borders of Kansas, obviously.
Yeah, well, there's 30 states, and he goes to large, associations of elected officials and promotes this as, hey, you should get this. It will help you keep your rolls clean, and it's free. So, and I asked Chris Kobach's people about what does this cost the state of Kansas, and they say it doesn't cost them anything, but I can't believe,
Well,
it's
to maintain
hard to
a database like that obviously takes some people hours, right?
Exactly. At the very least, staff time.
Now, you've come across some issues with cross-check and its accuracy. What have you found there, Peggy?
Well, here's the thing. So Chris Kobach goes out a lot. For instance, I used a cut from our State House Blend podcast this morning where Sam Zeff was asking him, you're using all these big numbers. And Kobach loves to say something like, 25,000, people are double registered in Kansas and other places. And
let me stop you there. Mark, just to be crystal clear, if you happen to be registered in more than one state, is that against the law?
Absolutely not.
Because
there are literally tens of millions of people who are dual registered. I grew up in Texas. I went to college in Massachusetts. I moved to Missouri after I finished college. I'm sure unless Texas has cleaned up its registrations, I'm still registered to vote in Texas.
The issue on the table here this morning is this notion of actually voting in more than one state. That's casting a ballot is the question.
Dual voting is illegal. Dual registration is not illegal, and it is incredibly common.
Okay, and Peggy, I cut you off. Go ahead and tell us more about CrossCheck.
So CrossCheck now is this huge database. And while some people, for instance, I started looking at this because Rolling Stone had a piece about how CrossCheck is being used by Kobach to really go after minorities and African-Americans and trying to disenfranchise minority voters.
Does he deny that?
I never got to talk to him about it. He couldn't deny it. That said, I didn't find that. I did not find proof of that at all. I did find that Kobach is using CrossCheck really sort of in an inappropriate manner, in being able to say, I've got these tens of thousands of voter registrations, and boy, that's proof that there's all this voter fraud. And that is not proof. And he's using it to convict these people because all six convictions came from CrossCheck.
And what's the problem with CrossCheck? Why isn't it eminently reliable?
Mark and I had a great conversation about this a month or so when I was in his office. But essentially, it's just too simplistic. When they run the search terms, all they check are his first name, last name, date of birth. Well, there's Mark and I talked about the curse of the common name, and he has one. And he
I have
probably
a common name. When I came to Kansas City in 1980, there were four lawyers in Kansas City whose name was Mark Johnson.
Ah.
Now, four.
That's not good for business, Mark.
Absolutely. Four in one profession. Goodness knows how many Mark Johnsons there are in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
As I told Peggy, the problem is how they match. They get tens of millions of names throughout the country, and they match by first name, last name, date of birth. In their instructions that they give to all of the states, they very clearly say that one of the things that will happen is false positives. In other words, false matches. And if you have a common name, as I do, or a common name such as Jose Garcia, Jose Hernandez,
Harold Washington, something like that.
Where you literally have millions of people who have or hundreds of thousands of people who have the same name, or you have a father and son, junior and senior, who have the same name with the exception of the junior and senior, which is not matched for, it's like I said, first name, last name, date of birth, you will literally have millions of these matches, and it's what the states do with them that raises the potential for a problem.
So the insinuation here then, or the implication, is that Kobach has maybe exaggerated the number of folks who are double voting based on this cross-check system, which doesn't get you as far down the road towards an accurate look as maybe there needs to be.
Absolutely. And he doesn't go on to explain that after you run a cross-checks, matching program, then he hands it over to states. And in the states that I checked on, for instance, Michigan, they do a really good job of going through that line by line and running more filters, such a middle initial or a junior senior or a social security number or something like that. And they check the rolls that way. And then they even have a waiting period before that voter, they try to contact the voter, and then the voter is not purged until, years later. So the states are doing a good job, I think, of filtering, and many studies have found that to be true as well. But Kobach doesn't really talk about that.
And there's a different system that's available, too, out there, right?
It's called ERIC, and I can't quite remember the acronym. But basically, the Pew Charitable Trust founded this a few years ago, and it is a much better system. It uses a lot more qualifiers. It does have a one-time cost of $25,000 to a state. So, of course, many states are opting for that free one.
Mm-hmm.
But all election officials I talked to said you should go with ERIC, and they prefer that states don't use cross-check.
Yeah. Mark, can other secretaries of state around the country for the different states prosecute voter fraud cases like Chris Kobach can?
As far as I know, he is the only secretary of state that has that power.
Yeah.
So the answer is no.
No, not at all. Do we have any idea how much time and taxpayer money has been spent in Kobach's pursuit of stricter voting laws for Kansas?
I have no idea.
No idea. Hard to tell.
Because he won't talk to us about it. And he only says that it costs nothing. And we don't get to know about the staff time, for instance, that this takes. I also want to say that the other thing that's important here is that Kobach is advising Trump. President Trump. So,
which has been well covered and has all kinds of implications.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. Peggy Lowe, an investigative editor for KCUR, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
You can see her story on Randall Killian and the cross-check system at kcur.org. Mark Johnson's a partner at Denton's and teaches at both the KU School of Law and the Journalism School. Mark, nice to have you.
Steve, thanks very much.
Tomorrow, the media critics discuss the press's coverage of the president. That'll include the Peggy Lowe you just heard. And we wonder how journalism might change during the era of Donald Trump. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.